Well, it's nice to be here in, I think, what all of you say as Göteborg. Is that a good pronunciation? Because in America, it's pronounced Gothenburg. In Germany, it's Göteborg. And now here, I think it's Göteborg. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. And as far as my jet lag goes, I think it will only enhance my lectures, and I don't see that it will detract. At least I think my students back home would probably say that. So today, my topic, you know, is there the possibility of religious unity in the modern world? This is a question on which I have been sort of pondering for years, probably in my graduate studies, and probably as I'm teaching hundreds and hundreds of students over the years. And then, of course, with the backdrop of the world situation where there is such frictive, intense, and even destructive relationships between religious traditions, I think that it's in a way begging the question to present a topic on, is there the possibility of religious unity? I'm assuming in that title that that's something we want. But perhaps we do want it. Perhaps it is something for which we do long, given just centuries of a kind of conflict between religious traditions, not just interreligiously, but even intra-religiously, even within the family of certain religious traditions, there can be such tensions, and in many ways, maybe even worse. Protestants and Catholics, for example. So not just between, say, Muslims and Christians, but even within a family of traditions. We also know now, over the past few decades, that the tremendous tensions between the Sunnis and Shias within the Muslim family of traditions. And even in Islam, a tradition that thrives on this idea of unity and oneness. This seems to be such an important symbol for Islam. Please come right on in. We're just beginning. Yes, and Islam. In Islam, the idea that God is one and the community of worshipers are one, this is so important in Islam. And this has always rubbed Islam historically in difficult ways. The very fact that there is any division among worshippers, the Sunni and Shia distinctions, is itself a kind of challenge built right there within the Muslim tradition. Even though the Muslims themselves seek the idea of religious unity as a very important part of their symbolism. So the question of religious unity, you know, what do I mean by religious unity? What do others mean by religious unity? Over the years, my students often will say, you know, Professor Schweig, these religions are ultimately saying the same thing, aren't they? This is a comment that I will often get. They're really saying the same thing, aren't they? And then, of course, when I try to respond back, I kind of get tongue-tied because I go kind of, yes, no, yes, no. And they eventually walk out of the room as I'm just muttering positives and negatives for the next 10 or 15 minutes. We can't say that every religion is the same. We can't. Phenomenologically, we look at religion and we see such varieties, such colorful expressions of a relationship with the divine. We find just enormous diversity in the ways that the ultimate truth is projected. We find doctrinal differences, radically different doctrines between religious traditions. And perhaps that's a little scary. That may be a little scary, and that may be why the students will have to come up to me and say, you know, I think they're really just saying the same thing. It's scary because, on the one hand, we like to appreciate individuals, but if they're too individualized, if they're too much claiming something about the absolute truth that conflicts with my conception of the absolute truth, well, it sounds like we've got a fight on our hands here. We've got a competition. You know, there was a very well-known theologian, Rudolf Otto, of the 20th century, earlier part of the 20th century, as many of you probably know. He was a German Lutheran comparativist of religions, one of the first, really. And he's famed for writing Das Heilige, or the idea of the holy, as it's translated in the English edition. And he does something there that's, I think, very interesting. He claims that all religions really can be understood along this axis of mysterium tremendum et fascinans. This is his sort of Latin formula, mysterium tremendum et fascinans. Well, I'm fascinans with his formula because I don't think it really does the job, but I think that he attempts to find this sort of trajectory along which many religious traditions sort of project themselves theologically. This idea, mysterium tremendum, that God is, or that the divine is very daunting and is sublime and even scary and a sense of overwhelming power on the one hand. And on the other hand, a sense of this fascination, this attraction, this allurement. And I think that he's got something there. But he seems to require that these two sort of experiences of the divinity are kind of dialectically glued together, and that there can't be much variation. We're going to return to that in a minute, or in a few minutes. And by the way, if you have any comments or questions, I like to run an informal thing here. So if I say something that's not quite clear, either due to my jet lag or just due to just imprecision on my part or carelessness, please don't hesitate to, you know, call my attention to it and so on. And we will have later in this discussion time for you to make your comments and or questions and so on. And we'll have a little break and then come back and look at some images if your computer can digest the megabytes. Yeah. So this same theologian, though, wrote a much less known book. He was famous for this Das Heilige book. I think it was 1930, I think it was then that he came out with that book. But there's a much less known book, which I find even more fascinating. And it's a rather protracted title. It's called India's Religion of Grace Compared... I'm sorry, what is it? It's so long I can't even remember it. Christianity and India's Religion of Grace Compared and Contrasted. Okay. I don't think any publisher in this day and age would go for a title that long, but that's the title. And what Rudolf Otto does there is something terribly interesting and speaks to our topic today. He very deliberately sets out on a project to find that religious tradition in the world that competes with Christianity in claiming the hearts of humans. He wants to find that religious tradition, which really is, well, in some sense, a competitor. No, not in some sense. He wants to find the competitor. He calls it that. He wants to find the sort of dangerous other, the one that comes dangerously close to being able to claim the hearts of humans in claiming their allegiance to a divinity. So he searched the world for that. And what he came across was the theistic tradition of India, known as Vaishnavism. Those traditions under Vaishnavism are those that focus on the worship and theology of the divinity of Vishnu, Vaishnava, Vishnu, or Krishna. And he stayed in India for a long period of time to seek out what was this tradition. He found that Vaishnava tradition was something that was terribly competitive. And so he set up this kind of competition. Now, to give you the upshot of the whole thing, the end result of the whole thing, he set up this competition, and of course Christianity won. Well, he was convening over the competition, and since it was important for one of them to win, in every competition, one there has to be a winner and there has to be a loser. So his a priori assumption was that religions need to compete. I don't think that that's too healthy for us to think of religions competing. That would be tantamount to, my competing with Ferdinando. Whose mother is better? It would be something like that. I would say to Ferdinando, hey, I'll tell you why my mother is better than yours, okay? I mean, the whole premise of the thing, to even begin to think that I can actually insist that my mother is better than someone else's mother, is already flawed in many ways. And we're going to move toward that that subject in a few minutes as well. But this question of religious unity, is this something that we want? Is it something that we can really talk about? Unity. Is there a way for religions to be genuinely joined together? And is this something that we really want? And what kind of joining would this look like? How would these traditions be joined? In what way? I will claim to you today that over the years of studying religious traditions of the world and conducting classes on comparative religion year after year after year, I don't think there's any way to join religious traditions doctrinally. The doctrines are so different. They are so much tradition specific. They are often clothed with a particular cultural bias, which is not necessarily bad, but it's just, I think, the situation. There's so much that's so different between one doctrine of a religious tradition and another that I don't think there's any hope to go toward doctrine. There was a period of time, I think 2 decades ago, where scholars thought, ethics. And they were sort of drawing from the Western ethical stance that there's something intuitional about ethics that should show up in religious traditions that would allow traditions to find some sense of unity and linking. But they found out that even ethics was very differently projected from one tradition to another. Some thought, well, you can find the golden rule in every religious tradition. In some ways, you can, kind of. You can find, for example, a negative version of the golden rule in Confucianism. In other words, the golden rule that we know is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Well, in Confucius's mind, he thought that to put it negatively was much more open and more inclusive. And I frankly agree with him. He said, don't do anything to others that you wouldn't want them to do unto you. So, in other words, it's presumptuous for me to do unto Ferdinando. I'm going to be picking on you today. Is that all right? It's your job.
My role.
That's right. It's your role. That's why he's up here. That's right. So, aside from the technical aspects. But it's presumptuous for me to do unto Ferdinando what I would want done unto me. Why don't I make sure I don't do negative things? And then I can find out what he wants me to do. Anyway, we won't go into the details of that, but there are problems with the way even ethics are projected by religious traditions in terms of finding some kind of unity, some kind of way of some commonality. Even there, it was hard to find. And these scholars that came together and wrote some volumes on the subject found that ethics, too, presented an enormous amount of diversity, variation, and that there wasn't much hope to look toward ethics for a sense of religious unity. Well, what about theologically? Oh, well, this is the no-brainer. People claim a certain truth, or they possess a certain truth claim. God is this way or God is that way, and how dare you say anything different? If you have to be wrong because I have to be right. So here, this sense of competitiveness was very much present there when conflicting truth claims would meet one another, and one had to be dissolved to make sure that the other was sustained. It gets pretty dismal as we go along this this exploration, right? Is there any hope? Is there any way? The Dalai Lama, as he is known to do, goes a lot to these interfaith meetings and conferences in the world. And he is, I think one could say, generally a lover of peace. I mean, I think he is a model of someone who promotes peace. I think that he's seen as a modern-day symbol in the West, as a religious leader, as a great man of peace and harmony. And he gave a talk at an interfaith dialogue conference, and I'm going to have to paraphrase, of course, what he said, but he said, everyone here wants peace and love and harmony, and he sort of brings out these rather grand themes that seem to speak to all of us. And he insists, in his very polite and very humble way, that these are all things that we want. But I found that very unacceptable, because this is what he wants. And these themes of love and peace and harmony, nonviolence, and so on, are things, again, that are subtly clothed by the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And that what is harmony for one tradition is not necessarily harmony for another. What is ahimsa or non-harm for one tradition is not necessarily the same thing for another. So again, even in his wonderful words that everyone seemed to love, I find a tremendous presumptuousness in there. I felt like he was telling me that I should be a Tibetan Buddhist when I was reading his words. And I don't think that lends itself toward true dialogue. I think it was wonderful for me to read and hear what he feels would be the basis of such a dialogue. And maybe even more importantly, he was expressing those things that he feels are the most important. So again, where to go for this sense of religious unity? Where do we go? Do we remain hopelessly and helplessly sort of tormented by a kind of what may appear to be a kind of a theological pothole into which we find ourselves sort of just stuck in kind of a and we can't get out of it, and there's not even a tow truck we can call to pull us. We're just not. Where do we go? It seems to be a never-ending pursuit. Recently, I was invited to a movie theater, kind of in back where I live. There's this sort of classy little theater, old-time theater, where they show documentaries and they have experts come and talk about the films. It's a very nice kind of forum. And they asked me to come and talk about a film called One. This is very interesting because this was a bunch of guys, three guys up in Michigan, who one day said, let's make a film. And they said, well, what would it be about? Well, let's make it about religion, oneness of religion. Let's just call it One. And it was very informal. They're not trained in religion, comparative religion, or any subject in religion, but they decided to kind of just see if they could contact some leaders in the world, religious leaders in the world, and interview them about whether or not there was this oneness. They were sort of on a pilgrimage of their own, sort of informal, but apparently it turned out to be quite a committed pilgrimage, and they did interview many sort of illustrious personalities in the world of religion today. I found it so ironic. While they were insisting on oneness, each one of these speakers sounded so different. But they still insisted that there was a oneness. Again, expressing this ardent desire to find this oneness. So for heaven's sake, where is this oneness? Where is this oneness? Well, let me throw some things out at all of you and perhaps we can test some of my theories. So this is not so much of a lecture hall; it's more of a lab. And I'm the scientist, and you're the I don't think it's polite to call my audience lab rats, but so I'm hesitant to call you that. But perhaps you're functioning in a similar way. So let me test these things on all of you and see. But in this lab situation, this is where the rats can talk back to the scientist, okay, and tell him a thing or two. So that's not usually the case with scientists and rats, okay? So I often speak about religion as a human endeavor. It's a particular human endeavor. I give sometimes to my students a very easy sort of nutshell definition, a working definition of what religion is. First, I read to them about 25 different definitions of religion. That religion is this very obscure thing. It has the word religion itself has hardly any denotative force whatsoever. And so really, when we say religion, we don't really know what we're talking about. Usually we fall back onto a personal conception that we think it is and that we have no idea what the other person's thinking that it is. And yet we both talk about it. So it's this word that is so troublesome. There's a lot to say about this word, but we won't get too distracted. But I offer a definition after they get very bewildered by all of this whole litany of definitions from many scholars, thinkers, writers, and so on. And I make it very simple. I say, Religion is the human striving for what is conceived of as ultimacy. The human striving. It's a very simple definition, but it's kind of loaded, okay? The human striving for what is considered ultimate. It's sort of an open-ended definition. But I first talk about humans. The assumption here is that religion is a specifically human endeavor, and we don't really find religion occurring in other species. Now, I could be wrong, but I have never seen a bunch of chipmunks in a prayer meeting. I've just never seen this, and I don't expect to see this. Again, I could be wrong, and I am willing to, you know, I don't know what happens here in Sweden, but in America, they don't pray. They really don't. And so-called praying mantises, I don't believe they're praying, okay? This bug that is sort of, I don't believe that's true prayer. But, and so, religion is specifically a human endeavor. And humans, while animals don't take up religion, humans are terrible animals. We're horrible at being animals. Have you ever noticed? We're just horrible at it. We don't know how to be good animals. And animals don't know how to be religious. Humans are terrible at being animals. The animals, all animals, and we do too, we all eat. But humans don't know what to eat. They don't know how to eat. They don't know. We use sticks. We use forks. We use hands. We use straws. We don't know what we're doing. I mean, we'll just do anything. And we don't know what to eat. We don't know when to eat. Some students told me they ate dinner at 2 in the morning, and then came to my class at 9:30, and you could see that they certainly were up late. We humans, we just don't know what to eat, how to eat, where to eat. Some of it, we sit on tables, some of it, we sit on the floors. We just don't have a sense about it. Sleeping, that's something I could use a little later today. I'm sure we'll catch up on that. But I'm a good example of that. Where does, you know, when you're taking an international flight, I mean, you can't sleep on those things, you know. So sleeping. Again, staying up late. Animals have a certain sense of rhythm. They always go to sleep at the same time. Humans never have that kind of rhythm. We just don't have it. You know, there's always some reason why we have to stay up, or sometimes we sleep too much, whatever. We're not good. We're just not good animals. Sleep, eating, sleeping, mating. Oh, I don't think I want to go into that one. We don't know when to mate, how to mate. We're not good at it. We just don't have a sense. It's often used recreationally. It's used cheaply. It's not used for procreative purposes. Animals, there's a mating season, I think. Again, I'm speaking a little outside my field. I'm not a zoologist or a biologist. But mating and defending. Animals generally are violent in protective ways, as far as I know. I know some animals can be aggressive and caustic, but most of the time, all animals are governed by instinct. So even if it is an aggressiveness there, if there is an aggressiveness, it is conducted by instinct. Humans don't have much instinct. And not only can humans be the most unbelievably aggressive animals in defending themselves, but we can be offensive, not just defensive. In fact, we humans have the capacity even to enjoy the pain of others. Amazingly. And this is, there's no animal that actually enjoys, gets to this level of, you might say, evil, actually enjoys the pain of others. Methodically arranges for hurting others, destroying others. We humans are a very strange species. We're bad animals. We're not good animals. But yet this same human species can produce a Mother Teresa, can produce meditators on the supreme, and achieve a certain amazing level of mind over matter. Tremendous feats of the human mind and heart have been achieved in religion. But even religion will be used in the service of hurt and pain. So we have such a mixed thing in religion. In the history of religion, really, more blood has been spilled in the name of religion than even specifically political causes. Religion has been a very bloody affair. It does not have a good record. And it still doesn't have a good record. So these sort of things add to the complication of what religion is. Where is religion? If my religion's so busy killing you and your religion, then why do we want unity? Unity may mean the obliteration of me so you can feel the unity of you. It can be a narcissistic thing. Religious unity could be a kind of closet term for totalitarianism. That's not what we're talking about, ideally, in terms of religious unity. The human striving for what is considered ultimate. Striving. Those humans who are deeply religious, religious in the best sense of the term, are striving. They are undergoing various processes, perhaps austerities, maybe different forms of worship may be taken up. There's a tremendous striving, and the striving is not often just a compartmentalized part of the human life, but it's something that pervades one's life, something that takes over one's life. Even if appearing to go to job A or job B or job C, it is something that is at every moment something that preoccupies such a human. So there can be a tremendous and deep striving of the human spirit for what is considered ultimate. Ultimacy. Religion is the realm of ultimate, of ultimates, you might say. I mean, even if one is not all that religious in this life, where does religion show up? Often at birth, marriage, and death. I mean, these are sort of ultimate realms, ultimate rites of passage for human beings. And even a very non-religious person, or a-religious or atheistic person, often likes to have the religious pop up even at those times. It's maybe a bad habit, or maybe it just feels right somehow. Religion is concerned with ultimates. Religion is that thing we hang on to if we know we're about to die. The highest thing we know is what religion is about. The very concept that there is something highest is itself, I would claim, a deep part of what the realm of religious is all about. A sense of ultimacy. Let me expand upon this idea of ultimacy a little bit. Every religious tradition, this is where I kind of give sub-definitions. Every religious tradition has some projection, some conception of the supreme unlimited. Every religious tradition has this. And every religious tradition speaks of this supreme unlimited in a form that is apparently limiting the supreme unlimited. But to them, does not limit the supreme unlimited, but in some sense enhances the access to the supreme unlimited. So, let me just make sure I've said this again. This is probably too much for a jet-lagged mind of mine to go into now, but the idea here is that the supreme unlimited is often brought to the forefront in every religious tradition in an apparently limited form, which does not limit the supreme unlimited, but rather reveals the supreme unlimited in a very special and powerful way. But to outsiders is seen as limiting the supreme unlimited, and how dare you say the supreme unlimited comes in that form, manifests in that form. So to an outsider, it's blasphemy. To an insider, it's potentially idolatry. Boy, we've got problems. We've got problems, ladies and gentlemen. To insiders, the problem is we make something maybe much more than what it is. There's that danger of idolatry. And then on the outside of the tradition, there's the danger of blasphemy, making much less than what it is. Reductionism. So when we talk about ultimate things, we have problems in talking about these ultimate things. We're either it either seems to be a kind of the action of apotheosis, right? We're familiar with that, apotheosis. Giving something divine status, where to an outsider, it has no business having divine status. Or to an outsider, it appears to be something that doesn't represent or reveal the divine at all. Thus, religions fight over or feel a tension between their respective limited, so-called limited forms that don't limit the supreme unlimited, but to one another it does. Am I too convoluted here, or am I fairly clear? Is it right? The supreme unlimited manifesting in a limited form. Maybe give an example, okay? God, in some sense, could be understood as representing the supreme unlimited, and then Jesus could be a special form of the supreme unlimited, an apparently limiting form. But for Christians, does not limit the supreme unlimited at all. In fact, gives such a powerful link and relationship to the supreme unlimited. Without Jesus, Christians don't have this access to the supreme unlimited. But meanwhile, you've got Muslims looking at this figure of Jesus saying, well, wait a minute, this is not God. This is not the Son of God. This is a prophet. Jesus is a prophet. And we even have a problem calling him a prophet because he's not married. And we don't believe he got crucified, by the way. If you don't have a crucified Christ, you know. I mean, anyway, you don't have Christianity. Anyway, so, I mean, again, a reductionism can be seen in this. Jews, on the other hand, look at Jesus and say, well, he was a Jew. What's the big deal? Well, there are a lot of Jews. The insider-outsider problem in understanding what religion is. Religion too often becomes a kind of narcissistic projection. I'll tell you what religion is, and perhaps I'm doing this even right here in front of you. Maybe as a scholar, I'm projecting to you what I think religion is when it really could be easily something else. But a scholar's job is to try to bring it all together. And so in this sense, I'm looking for the unity among religious traditions. So even there's unity in disunity. How about that? You got the outsider saying one thing and the insider saying another thing, and you got this very complex tapestry of friction, of insider-outsider frictions. Is there a solution? I think there's a solution. Okay, so here it comes. Here's the denouement. Here's my thesis. My thesis is, given the fact that religion is the human striving for what is considered ultimate, given the fact that every picture of ultimacy takes on a so-called limited form, which does not limit the supreme unlimited, but rather reveals it so powerfully to humans, but is so often misunderstood by outsiders. Given all of this, what is it that potentially can join humans together from any religious tradition? What is it that we're missing? My claim is that we're missing the very heart of religion. My claim is that the very action of taking the supreme unlimited and finding revealed, that supreme unlimited revealed so magnificently through an apparently limiting form, that action, that kind of structure is itself a structure more akin to art, more akin to the concept of beauty, more related to love. The ability to see the whole within the part is an action of the heart. We can get back to Ferdinando's mother. I really can't tell him that my mother is better than his mother. That doesn't speak to the point. What is the point? Ferdinando, how much do you love your mother? Tell me about it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we can go into that later, okay? I'm not really asking you this now, okay? Okay, fine. Maybe over dinner tomorrow, something like that. Okay, that's fine. But the idea is that it's not whose mother is better. It's more along the lines of what St. Augustine starts off one of his confessions with. He says, what do I love when I love my God? This is the question we need to be asking one another. It's in this question that we can find the unity of all religions, I would claim. And one day I'm going to write about this. I just have too many other writing projects right now, overdue book deadlines, etc. One of which I just made, but I have three others. So there's one book that's 5 years overdue. Anyway, I don't want to reveal these things to you because it's atrocious. And I don't want to ever give any, if any of you are students in this arena, don't want to ever think that you can hand in your papers late because scholars do it all the time, professors do it all the time. but I think that we're here. I think it behooves all spiritual aspirants, all religious practitioners, to dive deeply within their particular religious traditions. Let me go back to Rudolf Otto, who I criticized heavily earlier, but he says something wonderful. He says, initially, he wants to find that special gift that each tradition offers. His a priori assumption was wonderful. His a priori assumption was that every religious tradition offers some special gift to humanity. Some wonderful thing is revealed to humanity. Every religious tradition, this is what he really, in some sense, starts with, and I think quite beautifully. And I would like to adopt his a priori assumption here. That if religion is what it is, something so intensely personal and meaningful, and taking up the whole of one's life, something to which we are willing to live for and die for, not saying whether this is right or wrong. I'm not evaluating it from the point of view of the philosophy of religion. I'm looking at it as something that grabs the heart. If it does grab the heart, then it behooves us to really look for and dive into each of our traditions to find what is it saying at its deepest level about love. I mean, I could, you know, make a list of Ferdinando's mother's qualities. You know, does she cook well? Does she have an outside job? And all these qualities. We can go down the list and we can do a comparison. And I don't know. You know, is that meaningful? Is that what we really want to do? No, I don't think so. I think what we really want to do is, you know, what do you love when you love your mom? What do you love when you love the divine? It's only on that basis, I would proffer, that there can be a unity of religions. Only when the human hearts can share what it is that moves them to the divine, do we have some basis of unity. Not saying that your God has to be my God, or my concept of transcendence needs to obliterate your God, but rather, what do you love when you love the divine? And I'm not saying your love is going to be exactly the same as my love. No, I want to hear from you. I don't want the Dalai Lama telling me what I love. I don't want him telling me this. Would he be interested in hearing what I love in the concept of harmony that I could derive from my religious tradition? I hope so. Because that's what we have to share. So, just to wind this segment of the talk up, and then I open up for some comments, questions, then we can take a little break. Is that all right, Ferdinand? It's fine. The unity of religions begins by looking at the heart of religion and then sharing it with others. It begins there, and ironically, it also ends there. That is the means, that is the end. If we can't share this most magnificent gift that religion offers, then how much are you really receiving the gift in the first place? I question this. I seriously question it. How much are we able to receive this gift, this deepest gift that religion offers, if we cannot share it? I'll just end with a little anecdote here. And then open up. Over the years, it's always interesting. You always have certain students that take an interest in what you're teaching and so on. Well, I had one who had a special interest in me to the point where he would follow me to my office every time I would end my talk, my lecture. And he was a very, you know, devout Christian. And he had it in his mind that I am going to convert Schweig into being a Christian. Although he didn't know whether I was a Christian or not. But all he knew is that I wasn't the Christian that he was. And that was good enough to put Justin on a mission to convert Schweig. So every single class he would come back, he was like a leech. You know, every time I ended my lecture, I knew, oh, here comes Justin. Oh, here he comes, like clockwork, you know. Sometimes I would try to, like, escape out of the room quickly, you know, like, make like I had to go off to a faculty meeting, but it never worked. Justin was right on my tail, and there he was. And he'd follow me right into my office, and he'd make himself very comfortable in the chair right next to mine, and he would, you know, talk shop, talk Christianity, talk doctrine. So finally, one day, I sort of got the message. I said, you know, I really need to talk to Justin. I can't just keep, you know, sort of play this game. I said, Justin, may I ask you a question? He said, yeah. I said, Justin, tell me what is so wonderful about what it is that you believe in, what you practice. What is it that you love so much that you're so eager to tell me about it? What is it? Tell me. He stopped for a minute and then he went right back into his doctrinal jargon. And he wasn't personal at all and so on. I said, Justin, you're not hearing me. Tell me what you love. I want to hear what grabs you. Tell me that. And he stopped again. It was kind of a curious thing because people don't generally ask this. And he reverted back to his doctrinal jargon once again. I said, Justin, I'm going to have to kick you out of my office unless you answer my question. Okay? You've been following me here every day. And I think it's because you really have something to say to me. But you've not been saying it yet. Tell me. Finally, please listen to me. What is it that you love? Okay, you say Jesus is God. What? Tell me. How do you feel his love? What do you love about him? Tell me this. Well, you have to absorb this a little bit. And he started telling me. And boy, did we have just a wonderful connection. He finally was telling me something that was meaningful. And after he told me, I said, Justin, thank you. And you know, he didn't follow me anymore to class. Isn't that odd? So, I'll just stop there and ask any of you if you have any comments, anything to add, how did the experiment go? Did it make sense? What do you think? What's just your natural reaction? And please feel free to be as open and as irreverent with me as you may want to. Yeah.
This idea of finding a unity in religions, I'm wondering if you think it necessarily precludes the idea of competition between religions, or if there can be perhaps on some, you know, a kind of a more friendly competition than what we've been used to in the history of the world.
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable, I don't take it so much as it's almost a rhetorical question, because I think, yes, I think it's natural. I'm not suggesting that we obliterate the field of the philosophy of religion, for example. Okay, I have no interest in saying, look, all you fellows over there and gals over there in philosophy of religion, retire. Let's clean up. We make fields. Well, why don't we obliterate them too? Let's get rid of you people. No, I think it's fascinating to examine the intrinsic logic of a faith. Its theological integrity. I think that's a very valuable thing, actually. And that can be another kind of sharing. But without the other, I don't know. It can be, in the university, the very protective university intellectual setting, it's very safe. But, you know, on the street, I don't know. I don't know how much that can happen in terms of the competitiveness, in terms of the ability to share. I think the university setting, the academic or intellectual setting, is a very protected setting. I think we could do that here.
Do what? Have competition without this unity, or have competition at all?
I think both.
Okay.
In other words, I think that I think that we can look at the intrinsically logical or theologically rational claims of religion, compare them, contrast them. I think we can do that. I'm not precluding that at all. But on the street, it takes a different form. It's more combative. Or it's more alienating. Like, I just don't even want to talk to you. And many religious practitioners say, here's someone else. Here's another. Here is the other, and I just prefer to ignore them. So thus we have, or I acknowledge that they exist, so then I have, so there's ignorance, then there's tolerance. Okay, I know you're different than me, I tolerate you, but you know what, I don't even want to talk to you. I know that you exist. I accept that you exist. I'm not going to kill you. I would like to, but I'm not going to. There are various degrees of tolerance, right? I don't like that you exist, but I'm going to tolerate you. So is that what we want? A lot of people promote religious tolerance. We need more religious tolerance in the world. Like heck, we don't need religious tolerance in this world. It's just waiting to erupt. Religious understanding, that would be nice. But I'm talking about even something higher than that. So religious understanding, I think, is what you're talking about. Understanding at different levels. One of those can be certainly a comparative. Well, for heaven's sake, I spent so many years getting a doctorate in comparative religion. So I'd like to think that it's a worthwhile endeavor. My conclusion is, though, at the end of doing all this comparative work, is to really say, in some sense, you can't really compare religions. You can for a while, but ultimately, I mean, I can compare my mom with Ferdinando's. I mean, that could be an interesting thing, but after a while, I mean, really, what's the point of that? In religion, it may be a little different. I mean, we might want to find out what ideal motherhood is, okay? We might want to find out what the divine is and the different shades and colors.
Just thinking, the one breakdown of this analogy with comparing mothers is someone could conceivably convert, could do exactly what this guy wanted you to do, which is to convert to whatever idea.
I could move into Ferdinando's mom's house. And I mean, you know, hey, I could take on another mother that would be more dear to me than my own mother.
Okay.
I mean, that happens. Stepmothers, huh? Well, let's take this thing further, okay? Let's bleed this metaphor to death. Why not, you know?
Would there not then in that case be perhaps, in certain cases, valid reason to do so? Your mother was abusive or whatever.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Someone might say, leave your house, come over to my house, my mom will be your mom.
Yes, but to me, it wouldn't be valid necessarily on an intellectual level, merely. But it would be, there'd be something that really speaks to me. This is, Ferdinando's mom turns out to love me more than my own mom. Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh, I feel that love. Not that, oh, she's a better cook. Oh, heck, I'm moving in, Ferdinando. See, then it's just utilitarian. There's by the way, I converted to Christianity because I'm afraid of going to hell for eternity. So I better, you know. Or, oh no, I became a Muslim because if I do go to hell, I can get out eventually. See, they don't have an eternal hell. A lot of Christian denominations have an eternal hell. So, you know, I can pick and choose, sort of like when my wife and I tried to figure out what would be our itinerary in traveling to Europe. Like, well, we could go here, or we can go there. What would be more difficult? What would be more expensive? What would be less? You know, we can do that. We can sort of construct a divine itinerary. But that's not love. I can use the divine for my own interests. I can go to Ferdinando's mom for cooking, because my mom's not such a good cook, you know? But that's empty. It's also selfish. It's self-centered. It's what's concerning me. Merold Westfall, a philosopher of religion, wrote a book called, I love the name, God, Guilt, and Death. Love it. I bought the book just for the title. But actually, it turns out to be really quite a good book. God, Guilt, and Death, an excellent book. And he talks about useless religion. It doesn't sound as bad as it sounds in English. Useless, when something's useless, it means it's worthless, has no... But what he means by that, if I'm recalling the term correctly, what he means is that it's not religion that's used for something else. Like for politics. It's religion for its own sake. That's love. I always love quoting Rabia, the famous female mystic of Islam. who said, you know, if I worship you, Lord, in hopes of attaining heaven, then exclude me from heaven. If I worship you out of fear of hell, throw me in there. But if I worship you for your own sake, please don't withhold from me your eternal beauty. Again, a rough paraphrasing of it, but you got the idea. Religion for its own sake, you know. So I basically would agree that religion can be something that can be weighed out and assessed and so on. But ultimately, it goes beyond that, even in decisions of one's own embracing a tradition. I think it comes right down to the heart and the heart of the divine.
You had this conviction that this idea of when you do get together and discuss more the nitty-gritty of a tradition and perhaps debate about, not just discuss them, but actually legitimately debate about things, that works in the academic world but not on the street. Why?
I think that practitioners are insecure. I think humans in general suffer from an acute case of insecurity, period. And it acts itself out in the religious arena, maybe even more. It's a sensitive area. Faith can be very delicate at first. I think every tradition has the ability to produce practitioners who are extremely strong in their faiths, and a faith that won't be rattled when called into question. That's more the exception than the rule, I think. And I think too often religion is utilitarian. I think that we use it to get comfortable. You know, the critics of religion tell us about that. Marx, Freud, you know. So I think that it's too easily something that becomes not religion for its own sake, but religion for our sake. Which is all right, but I think we have deeper levels to pursue.
May I suggest a little break now?
A little break, and then we had one. Should I take one other quick question here? Or comment? And then we'll take a break. Is that all right?
Yeah.
You've been talking about religion as a quest for the human striving for what is conceived of as ultimate. What would you say to those people who say, your definition makes no sense to me? There is nothing I conceive of as ultimate. And what would you say to the majority of people in Sweden and England who are not religious practitioners,
right,
in any meaningful sense?
Right. I think that I would like to think that I'm speaking about natural religion, not religion necessarily in particular traditions, but something, a homo religiosus, that there's a religious dimension to all human existence. And that whether we're aware of it or not, we all hold on to something ultimate in our lives. There's something that's ultimate. I don't know what it is. And sometimes we don't know what it is for ourselves, what to speak of for others. I just don't think I'm in a position to tell you what's ultimate for you. I would like to hear what's ultimately valuable.
That's an
a priori assumption that I'm working with, that everyone has something that's ultimate for them. But I'm also saying that I have no right to tell you what's ultimate for you. Rather, real unity happens when you share with me, first of all, whether you can go down deep and find what is ultimate in your being, and if I can do the same in mine, and then we get together. And we talk about that. We share that.
Is I'd like to suggest that is culturally preconditioned by your religious, philosophical, and academic background.
We can relativize it, yeah. But I don't find in relativizing it any depletion of what's being said, because again, what we'd have to do is attack my argument from the point of view that there is nothing ultimate. I don't have anything ultimate in my life. Then my whole theory goes to pot. My assumption is that we all have that. I said that if we all knew right now we only have 5 more minutes to live, all of us just found out we have 5 minutes to live. My assumption is that we will all be scrambling for what is ultimate. What has been ultimate, what we would hope would be ultimate, and what is ultimate for us now. I could be wrong. I don't think I am. Of course, no scholar thinks that they're wrong when they're basing a whole theory on some. But every theory has its assumptions. Every theory has its assumptions. I just, over the years, I'm comfortable with those assumptions. In my experience, in my studies, that's what I've come up with. I'm not comfortable in telling you that that Buddha is the absolute truth, and that you, my dear friend, are missing out on the absolute truth because you're not Buddhist. I'm not even comfortable telling you that peace and harmony and love is the ultimate. I'm not comfortable telling you that. I need to hear from you when you've been doing this deep searching within. What is ultimate for you? To me, this is the ultimate sharing that needs to go on. And it is based on an assumption. You can attack my assumptions as we can attack any assumptions in any theories. But I'm pretty comfortable being attacked on that assumption that I'm working with. Yeah. Well, good. Why don't we then take a quick break and then for about 5-10 minutes, and then and I'll just be hanging around up here informally, and anyone wants to... Good.